This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Darkest Minds by Alexandra Bracken, performed by Amy McFadden. For Stephanie and Daniel, who were in every minivan with me. Prologue. When the white noise went off, we were in the garden pulling weeds. I always reacted badly to it. It didn't matter if I was outside, eating in the mess hall, or locked in my cabin. When it came, the shrieking tones blew up like a pipe bomb between my ears. Other girls at Thurmond could pick themselves up after a few minutes, shaking off the nausea and disorientation like the loose grass clinging to their camp uniforms. But me? Hours would pass before I was able to piece myself back together. This time should have been no different. But it was. I didn't see what had happened to provoke the punishment. We were working so close to the camp's electric fence that I could smell the singed air and feel the voltage it shed vibrating in my teeth. Maybe someone got brave and decided to step out of the garden's bounds. Or maybe, dreaming big, someone fulfilled all our fantasies and threw a rock at the head of the nearest Psi Special Forces soldier. That would have been worth it. The only thing I knew for certain was that the overhead speaker spurted out two warning blares, one short, one long. The skin on my neck crawled as I leaned forward into the damp dirt, hands pressed tightly against my ears, shoulders tensed to take the hit. The sound that came over the speakers wasn't really white noise. It wasn't that weird buzz that the air sometimes takes on when you're sitting alone in silence, or the faint hum of a computer monitor. To the United States government and its Department of Psi Youth, it was the love child of a car alarm and a dental drill, turned up high enough to make your ears bleed. Literally. The sound ripped out of the speakers and shredded every nerve in my body. It forced its way past my hands, roaring over the screams of 100 teenage freaks, and settled at the center of my brain, where I couldn't reach in and rip it out. My eyes flooded with tears. I tried to ram my face into the ground. All I could taste in my mouth was blood and dirt. A girl fell forward next to me, her mouth open in a cry I couldn't hear. Everything else faded out of focus. My body shook in time with the bursts of static, curling in on itself like an old, yellowing piece of paper. Someone's hands were shaking my shoulders. I heard someone say my name. Ruby! But I was too far gone to respond. Gone, gone, gone. Sinking until there was nothing. Like the earth had swallowed me up in a single, deep breath. Then, darkness. And silence. 1. Grace Summerfield was the first to die. The first in my fourth grade class, at least. I'm sure that by then thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of kids had already up and gone the same way she had. People were slow to piece it all together, or at least they had figured out the right way to keep us in the dark long after kids started dying. When the deaths finally came to light, my elementary school put a strict ban on teachers and staff talking to us about what was then called Everhart's disease, after Michael Everhart, the first kid known to have died of it. Soon, someone somewhere decided to give it a proper name, idiopathic adolescent acute neurodegeneration, IAAN for short. And then it wasn't just Michael's disease. It was all of ours. All the adults I knew buried the knowledge beneath lying smiles and hugs. I was still stuck in my own world of sunshine ponies and my race car collection. Looking back, I couldn't believe how naive I was, just how many clues I missed. Even big things like when my dad, a cop, started working longer hours and could barely stand to look at me when he finally did come home. My mom started me on a strict vitamin regimen and refused to let me be alone even for a few minutes. On the other hand, my parents were both only children. I didn't have any dead cousins to send up red flags, and my mom's refusal to let my dad install a soul-sucking vortex of trash and mindless entertainment, that thing commonly known as a television, meant that no scary news broadcasts rocked my world. This, combined with the CIA-grade parental control set up on our internet access, pretty much ensured I'd be far more concerned with how my stuffed animals were arranged on my bed than the possibility of dying before my 10th birthday. I was also completely unprepared for what happened on the 15th of September. It had rained the night before, so my parents sent me to school wearing red galoshes. In class, we talked about dinosaurs and practiced cursive before Mrs. Port dismissed us for lunch with her usual look of relief. I remember every detail of lunch that day clearly, not because I was sitting across from Grace at the table, but because she was the first, and because it wasn't supposed to happen. She wasn't old like Grandpop's had been. She didn't have cancer like Mom's friend Sarah, no allergies, no cough, no head injury, nothing. When she died, it came completely out of the blue, and none of us understood what it meant until it was too late. Grace was locked in deep debate about whether a fly was trapped inside her Jell-O cup. The red mass shivered as she waved it around, inching out over the edge of the container when she squeezed it a bit too tight. Naturally, everyone wanted to give their opinion on whether it was a fly or a piece of candy Grace had pushed in there, including me. "I'm not a liar," Grace said. "I just..." She stopped. The plastic cup slipped from her fingers, hitting the table. Her mouth was open, eyes fixed on something just beyond my head. Grace's brow was furrowed, almost as if she was listening to someone explain something very difficult. "Grace?" I remember saying. "Are you okay?" Her eyes rolled back, flashing white in the second it took for her eyelids to droop down. Grace let out a small sigh, not even strong enough to blow away the strands of brown hair stuck to her lips. All of us sitting nearby froze, though we must have had the same exact thought. She's fainted. A week or two before, Josh Preston had passed out on the playground because, as Mrs. Port explained, he didn't have enough sugar in his system, something stupid like that. A noon aide rushed over to the table. She was one of four old ladies with white visors and whistles who rotated lunch and playground duty during the week. I have no idea if she had any medical certifications beyond a vague notion of CPR, but she pulled Grace's sagging body to the ground all the same. She had a rapt audience as she pressed her ear to Grace's hot pink T-shirt, listening for a heartbeat that wasn't there. I don't know what the old lady thought, but she started yelling, and suddenly white visors and curious faces circled in on us. It wasn't until Ben Cho nudged Grace's limp hand with his sneaker that any of us realized she was dead. The other kids started screaming. One girl, Tess, was crying so hard she couldn't breathe. Small feet stampeded toward the cafeteria door. I just sat, surrounded by abandoned lunches, staring at the cup of Jell-O and letting terror crawl through me until my arms and legs felt like they would be frozen to the table forever. If the school security officer hadn't come and carried me outside, I don't know how long I would have stayed there. "Grace is dead," I was thinking. "Grace is dead? Grace is dead." And it got worse. A month later, after the first big waves of deaths, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a 5-step list of symptoms to help parents identify whether their kid was at risk for IAAN. By then, half my class was dead. My mom hid the list so well that I only found it by accident, when I climbed on top of the kitchen counter to look for the chocolate she kept hidden behind her baking supplies. "How to identify if your child is at risk," the flyer read. I recognized the flaming orange shade of the paper. It was the sheet Mrs. Port had sent home with her few remaining students days before. She had folded it twice and fastened it with 3 staples to prevent our reading it. "To the parents of Ruby only," was written on the outside and underlined 3 times. 3 times was serious. My parents would have grounded me for opening it. Luckily for me, it was already open. 1. Your child suddenly becomes sullen and withdrawn and/or loses interest in activities they previously enjoyed. 2. She or he begins to have abnormal difficulty in concentrating or suddenly becomes hyper-focused on tasks, resulting in she or he losing track of time and or neglecting him or herself or others. 3. She or he experiences hallucinations, vomiting, chronic migraines, memory loss, and or fainting spells. 4. She or he becomes prone to violent outbursts, unusually reckless behavior or self-injury, burns, bruising, and cuts that cannot be explained. 5. She or he develops behaviors or abilities that are inexplicable, dangerous, or cause you or others physical harm. If your child demonstrates any of the above symptoms, register him or her at IAAN.gov and wait to be contacted about the local hospital to which she or he should be taken. When I finished reading the flyer, I folded it back up neatly, put it exactly where I found it, and threw up in the sink. Grams phoned later that week, and in her usual to-the-point Grams way, explained everything to me. Kids were dying left and right, all about my age. But the doctors were working on it, and I wasn't supposed to be afraid, because I was her granddaughter, and I would be fine. I should be good and tell my parents if I felt anything weird, understand? Things turned from bad to terrifying very fast. A week after 3 of the 4 kids in my neighborhood were buried, the president made a formal address to the nation. Mom and Dad watched the live stream on the computer, and I listened from outside the office door. "My fellow Americans," President Gray began, "today we face a devastating crisis, one that threatens not only our children's lives, but the very future of our great nation. May it comfort you to know that in our time of need, we, in Washington, are developing programs, both to support the families affected by this horrid affliction and the children blessed enough to survive it." I wish I could have seen his face as he spoke, because I think he knew, he must have, that this threat, the crimp in our supposedly glorious future, had nothing to do with the kids who had died. Buried underground or burned into ash, they couldn't do anything but haunt the memories of the people who had loved them. They were gone. Forever. And that symptoms list, the one that was sent home folded and stapled by teachers, which was aired 100 times over on the news as the faces of the dead scrolled along the bottom of the screen, the government was never scared of the kids who might die, or the empty spaces they would leave behind. They were afraid of us, the ones who lived. 2. It rained the day they brought us to Thurmond, and it went on to rain straight through the week and the week after that. Freezing rain, the kind that would have been snow if it had been 5 degrees colder. I remember watching the drops trace frantic paths down the length of the school bus window. If I had been back at home, inside one of my parents' cars, I would have followed the drops' swerving routes across the cold glass with my fingertips. Now my hands were tied together behind my back, and the men in the black uniforms had packed 4 of us to a seat. There was barely room to breathe. The heat from 100-odd bodies fogged the bus windows, and it acted like a screen to the outside world. Later, the windows of the bright yellow buses they used to bring kids in would be smeared with black paint. They just hadn't thought of it yet. I was closest to the window on the 5-hour drive, so I could make out slivers of the passing landscape whenever the rain let up for a bit. It all looked exactly the same to me. Green farms, thick expanses of trees. We could have still been in Virginia for all I knew. The girl sitting next to me, the one that would later be classified blue, seemed to recognize a sign at one point because she leaned over me to get a better look. She looked a little familiar to me, like I had seen her face from around my town, or she was from the next one over. I think all of the kids with me were from Virginia, but there was no way to be sure because there was only one big rule, and that was silence. After they had picked me up from my house the day before, they'd kept me, along with the rest of the kids, in some kind of warehouse overnight. The room was washed in unnatural brightness, They sat us in a cluster on the dirty cement floor and pointed 3 floodlights toward us. We weren't allowed to sleep. My eyes were watering so badly from the dust that I couldn't see the clammy, pale faces around me, let alone the faces of the soldiers who stood just beyond the ring of lights, watching. In some weird way, they ceased to be whole men and women. In the gray haze of half-sleep, I processed them in small, terrifying pieces. The gasoline reek of shoe polish, the creak of stiff leather, the twist of disgust on their lips, the tip of a boot as it dug into my side, forcing me back awake. The next morning, the drive was completely silent except for the soldiers' radios and the kids that were crying toward the back of the bus. The kid sitting at the other end of our seat wet his pants, but he wasn't about to tell that to the red-haired PSF standing beside him. She had slapped him when he complained he hadn't eaten anything all day. I flexed my bare feet against the ground, trying to keep my legs still. Hunger was making my head feel funny, too, bubbling up every once in a while to overwhelm even the spikes of terror shooting through me. It was hard to focus, and harder to sit still. I felt like I was shrinking, trying to fade back into the seat and disappear completely. My hands were starting to lose feeling after being bound in the same position for so long. Trying to stretch the plastic band they'd tightened around them did nothing but force it to cut deeper into the soft skin there. Psy Special Forces. That's what the driver of the bus had called himself, and the others, when they collected us from the warehouse. You are to come with us on authority of the Psy Special Forces Commander Joseph Traylor. He held up a paper to prove it, so I guess it was true. I had been taught not to argue with adults anyway. The bus took a deep dip as it pulled off the narrow road and onto a smaller dirt one. The new vibrations woke whoever had been lucky or exhausted enough to fall asleep. They also sent the black uniforms into action. The men and women stood straighter and their attention snapped toward the windshield. I saw the towering fence first. The darkening gray sky cast everything in a moody, deep blue, but not the fence. It was glowing silver as the wind whistled through its open pockets. Just below my window were dozens of men and women in full uniform, escorting the bus in at a brisk jog. The PSFs in the control booth at the gate stood and saluted the driver as he navigated past them. The bus lurched to a stop, and we were all forced to stay deathly still as the camp gate slid shut behind us. The locks cracked through the silence like thunder as they came together again. We were not the first bus through. That had come a year before. We were not the last bus either. That would come in 3 more years when the camp's occupancy maxed out. There was a single breath of stillness before a soldier in a black rain poncho rapped on the bus door. The driver reached over and pulled the lever and ended anyone's hope that this was a short pit stop. The PSF was an enormous man. The kind you'd expect to play an evil giant in a movie, or a villain in a cartoon. He kept his hood up, masking his face, hair, and anything that would have let me recognize him later. I guess it didn't matter. He wasn't speaking for himself. He was speaking for the camp. "You will stand and exit the bus in an orderly fashion," he yelled. The driver tried to hand him the microphone, but the soldier knocked it away with his hand. "You will be divided into groups of 10, and you will be brought in for testing. Do not try to run. Do not speak. Do not do anything other than what is asked of you. Failure to follow these instructions will be met with punishment." At 10, I was one of the younger kids on the bus, though there were certainly a few kids younger. Most seemed to be 12, even 13. The hate and mistrust burning in the soldier's eyes might have shrunken my spine, but it only sparked rebellion in the older kids. "Go screw yourself!" someone yelled from the back of the bus. We all turned at once, just in time to see the PSF with the flaming red hair launch the butt of her rifle into the teenage boy's mouth. He let out a shriek of pain and surprise as the soldier did it again, and I saw a faint spray of blood burst from his mouth when he took his next angry breath. With his hands behind his back, there was no way he could block the attack. He just had to take it. They began moving kids off the bus, one seat of four at a time. But I was still watching that kid, the way he seemed to cloud the air around him with silent, toxic fury. I don't know if he felt me staring or what, but the boy turned around and met my gaze. He nodded at me, like an encouragement, and when he smiled, it was around a mouthful of bloody teeth. I felt myself being hauled up and out of my seat, and almost before I realized what was happening, I was slipping down the wet bus steps and tumbling into the pouring rain. A different PSF lifted me off my knees and guided me in the direction of two other girls about my age. Their clothes clung to them like old skin, translucent and drooping. There were nearly 20 PSFs on the ground, swarming the neat, small lines of kids. My feet had been completely swallowed by the mud, and I was shivering in my pajamas, but no one took notice, and no one came up to cut the plastic binding our hands. We waited, silently, tongues clamped between our teeth. I looked up to the clouds, turning my face to the pounding rain. It looked like the sky was falling, piece by piece. The last groups of four were being lifted off the bus and dropped onto the ground, including the boy with a broken face. He was the last one off, just behind a tall blonde girl with a blank stare. I could barely make them out through the sheet of rain and the foggy bus windows, but I was sure I saw the boy lean forward and whisper something into the girl's ear, just as she took the first step off the bus. She nodded, a quick jerk of her chin. The second her shoes touched the mud, she bolted to the right, ducking around the nearest PSF's hands. One of the PSFs barked out a terrifying, "Stop!" But she kept running straight for the gates. With everyone's attention turned toward her, no one thought to look back at the boy still on the bus. No one but me. He came slinking down the steps, the front of his white hooded sweatshirt stained with his own blood. The same PSF who had hit him before was now helping him down to the ground, as she had done for the rest of us. I watched her fingers close around his elbow and felt the echo of her grip on my own newly bruised skin. I watched him turn and say something to her, his face a mask of perfect calm. I watched the PSF let go of his arm, take her gun out of its holster, and without a word, without even blinking, stick the barrel inside of her mouth and pull the trigger. I don't know if I screamed aloud or if the strangled sound had come from the woman waking up to what she was doing 2 seconds too late to stop it. The image of her face, her slack jaw, her eyes bulging out of her skull, the ripple of suddenly loose skin, stayed burned into the air like a photo negative far longer than the explosion of pink, misty blood and clumps of hair against the bus. The kid standing next to me dropped into a dead faint, and then there wasn't a single one of us that wasn't screaming. The PSF hit the ground the exact same moment the girl was tackled into the mud. The rain washed the soldier's blood down off the bus windows and yellow panels, stretching the bloated dark lines, drawing them out as they disappeared completely. It was that fast. The boy was looking only at us. "Run!" he yelled through his broken teeth. "What are you doing? Run! Run!" And the first thing that went through my mind wasn't, "What are you?" or even, "Why?" It was, "But I have nowhere else to go." He might as well have blown the entire bus up for the panic it caused. Some kids listened and tried to bolt for the fence, only to have their path blocked by the line of soldiers in black that seemed to pour out of the air. Most just stood there and screamed and screamed and screamed, the rain falling all around, the mud sucking their feet down firmly in place. A girl knocked me down to the ground with her shoulder as the other PSFs rushed for the boy still standing in the bus doorway. The soldiers were yelling at us to sit on the ground, to stay frozen there. I did exactly as I was told. "Orange," I heard one of them yell into his walkie-talkie. "We have a situation at the main gate. I need restraints for an orange." It wasn't until after they had rounded us back up and had the boy with a broken face on the ground that I dared to look up. And that I began to wonder. dread trickling up my spine, if he was the only one who could do something like that, or if everyone around me was there because they could cause someone to hurt themselves that way too. Not me, the words blazed through my head. Not me. They made a mistake. A mistake. I watched with a feeling of hollowness at the center of my chest as one of the soldiers took a can of spray paint in hand and painted an enormous orange X over the boy's back. The boy had only stopped yelling because two PSFs had pulled a strange black mask down over the lower part of his face, like they were muzzling a dog. Tension beaded on my skin like sweat. They marched our lines through the camp toward the infirmary for sorting. As we walked, we saw kids heading in the opposite direction, from a row of pathetic wood cabins. All of them were wearing white uniforms, with a different colored X marked on each of their backs, and a number written in black above it. I saw five different colors in all: green, blue, yellow, orange, and red. The kids with the green and blue X's were allowed to walk freely, their hands swinging at their sides. Those with a faint yellow X, or an orange or red one, were forced to fight through the mud with their hands and feet in metal cuffs, a long chain connecting them in a line. The ones marked with orange smears had the muzzle-like masks over their faces. We were hurried into the bright lights and dry air of what a torn paper sign had labeled infirmary. The doctors and nurses lined the long hallway, watching us with frowns and shaking heads. The checkered tile floor became slick with rain and mud, and it took all of my concentration not to slip. My nose was filled with the smell of rubbing alcohol and fake lemon. We filed, one by one, up a dark cement staircase at the back of the first floor, which was filled with empty beds and limp white curtains. Not an orange. Not a red. I could feel my guts churning deep in the pit of my stomach. I couldn't stop seeing that woman's face, right when she pulled the trigger, or the mass of her bloody hair that had landed near my feet. I couldn't stop seeing my mom's face, when she had locked me out in the garage. I couldn't stop seeing Graham's face. She'll come, I thought. She'll come. She'll fix Mom and Dad, and she will come to get me. She'll come. She'll come. She'll come. Upstairs, they finally cut the plastic binding that tied our hands and divided us again, sending half down to the right end of the freezing hallway and half to the left. Both sides looked exactly the same, no more than a few closed doors and a small window at the very end. For a moment, I did nothing but watch the rain pelt that tiny, foggy pane of glass. Then the door on the left swung open with a low whine, and the face of a plump, middle-aged man appeared. He cast one look in our direction before whispering something to the PSF at the head of the group. One by one, more doors opened and more adults appeared. The only thing they had in common, aside from their white coats, was a shared look of suspicion. Without a single word of explanation, the PSFs began pulling and pushing kids toward each white coat and its associated office. The outburst of confused, distressed noises that erupted from the lines was hushed with a piercing buzzer. I fell back onto my heels, watching the doors shut one by one, wondering if I would ever see those kids again. What's wrong with us? My head felt like it was full of wet sand as I looked over my shoulder. The boy with a broken face was nowhere, but his memory had chased me all the way through the camp. Did they bring us here because they thought we had Everhart's disease? Did they think we were going to die? How had that boy made the PSF do what she had done? What had he said to her? I felt a hand slide into mine as I stood there, trembling hard enough for my joints to hurt. The girl, the same one that had pulled me down into the mud outside, gave me a fierce look. Her dark blonde hair was plastered against her skull, framing a pink scar that curved between her top lip and nose. Her dark eyes flashed, and when she spoke, I saw that they had cut the wires on her braces, but had left the metal nubs glued to her front teeth. "Don't be scared," she whispered. "Don't let them see." The handwritten label on the tag of her jacket said, "Samantha Dahl." It stuck up against the back of her neck like an afterthought. We stood shoulder to shoulder, close enough that our linked fingers were hidden between the fabric of my pajama pants and her purple puffer jacket. They had picked her up on the way to school the same morning they had come for me. That had been a day ago, but I remembered seeing her dark eyes burning bright with hate at the back of the van they had locked us in. She hadn't screamed as the others had. The kids who had disappeared through the doors now came back through them, clutching gray sweaters and shorts in their hands. Instead of falling back into our line, they were marched downstairs before anyone could think to get a word or questioning look in. They don't look hurt. I could smell permanent marker and something that might have been rubbing alcohol, but no one was bleeding or crying. When it was finally the girls' turn, the PSF at the head of the line forced us apart with a sharp jerk. I wanted to go in with her, to face whatever was behind the door. Anything had to be better than being alone again without anyone or anything to anchor myself to. My hands were shaking so badly that I had to cross my arms and grip my elbows to get them to stop. I stood at the front of the line, looking at the gleaming span of checkered tile between the PSF's black boots and my mud-splattered toes. I was already tired down to my bones from the sleepless night before, and the scent of the soldier's boot polish sent my head deeper into a fog. And then they called for me. I found myself in a dimly lit office, half the size of my cramped bedroom at home, with no memory of ever having walked into it. Name? I was looking at a cot and a strange halo-shaped gray machine hanging over it. The white coat's face appeared from behind the laptop on the table. He was a frail-looking man, whose thin silver glasses seemed to be in serious danger of sliding off his nose with every quick movement. His voice was unnaturally high, and he didn't so much as say the word as squeak it. I pressed my back against the closed door, trying to put space between me, the man, and the machine. The white coat followed my gaze to the cot. That's a scanner. There's nothing to be afraid of. I must not have looked convinced because he continued. Have you ever broken a bone or bumped your head? Do you know what a CT scan is? It was the patience in his voice that drew me forward a step. I shook my head. In a minute, I'm going to have you lie down, and I'll use that machine to check to make sure your head is all right. But first, you need to tell me your name. Make sure your head is all right. How did he know? Your name, he said, the words taking on a sudden edge. Ruby, I answered, and had to spell my last name for him. He began typing on the laptop, distracted for a moment. My eyes drifted back over to the machine, wondering how painful it would be for me to have the inside of my head inspected, wondering if he could somehow see what I had done. Damn, they're getting lazy, the white coat groused, more to himself than to me. Didn't they pre-classify you? I had no idea what he was talking about. When they picked you up, did they ask you questions? He asked, standing. The room wasn't large by any means. He was by my side in two steps, and I was in full panic and two heartbeats. Did your parents report your symptoms to the soldiers? Symptoms? I squeezed out. I don't have any symptoms. I don't have the... He shook his head, looking more annoyed than anything else. Calm down. You're safe here. I'm not going to hurt you. The white coat kept talking, his voice flat, something flickering in his eyes. The lines sounded practiced. There are many different kinds of symptoms, he explained, leaning down to look at me eye to eye. All I could see were his crooked front teeth and the dark circles rimming his eyes. His breath smelled like coffee and spearmint. Many different kinds of children. I'm going to take a picture of your brain, and it'll help us put you with the others who are like you. I shook my head. I don't have any symptoms. Grams is coming. She is. I swear she'll tell you, please. Tell me, sweetheart, are you very good at math and puzzles? Greens are incredibly smart and have astonishing memories. My mind jumped back to the kids outside. to the colored X's on the back of their shirts. Green, I thought. What had the other colors been? Red, blue, yellow, and orange, like the boy with the bloody mouth. All right, he said, taking a deep breath. Just lie back on that cot and we'll get started. Now, please. I didn't move. Thoughts were rushing too quickly to my head. It was a struggle to even look at him. Now, he repeated, moving toward the machine. Don't make me call in one of the soldiers. They won't be nearly as nice, believe me. A screen on the side panel came alive with a single touch, and then the machine itself lit up. At the center of a gray circle was a bright white light, blinking as it set itself up for another test. It was breathing out hot air in sputters and whines that seemed to prick every pore on my body. All I could think was, he'll know. He'll know what I did to them. My back was flat against the door again, my hand blindly searching for the handle. Every single lecture my dad had ever given me about strangers seemed to be coming true. This was not a safe place. This man was not nice. I was shaking so hard he might have thought I was going to faint. That, or he was going to force me onto the cot himself and hold me there until the machine came down and locked over me. I hadn't been ready to run before, but I was now. As my fingers tightened on the door handle, I felt his hand push through my unruly mass of dark hair and seize the back of my neck. The shock of his freezing hand on my flushed skin made me flinch, but it was the explosion of pain at the base of my skull that made me cry out. He stared at me, unblinking, his eyes suddenly unfocused. But I was seeing everything, impossible things. Hands drumming on a car's steering wheel, a woman in a black dress leaning forward to kiss me, a baseball flying toward my face out on a diamond, an endless stretch of green field, a hand running through a little girl's hair. The images played out behind my closed eyes like an old home movie. The shapes of people and objects burned themselves into my retinas and stayed there, floating around behind my eyelids like hungry ghosts. Not mine, my mind screamed. These don't belong to me. But how could they have been his? Each image? Were they memories? Thoughts? Then I saw more. A boy, the same scanner machine above him flickering and smoking. Yellow. I felt my lips form the words as if I had been there to say them. I saw a small red-haired girl from across a room much like this one, saw her lift a finger, and the table and laptop in front of her rise several inches from the ground. Blue. Again, the man's voice in my head. A boy holding a pencil between his hands, studying it with a terrifying intensity, the pencil bursting into flames. Red. Cards with pictures and numbers on them held up in front of a child's face. Green. I squeezed my eyes shut, but I couldn't pull back from the images that came next. The lines of marching, muzzled monsters. I was standing high above, looking down through the rain-spattered glass, but I saw the handcuffs and the chains. I saw everything. I'm not one of them. Please. 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 I fell, dropping to my knees, bracing my hands against the tile, trying to keep from being sick all over myself and the floor. The white coat's hand still gripped the back of my neck. I'm green, I sobbed, the words half lost to the machine's buzzing. The light had been bright before, but now it only amplified the pounding behind my eyes. I stared into his blank eyes, willing him to believe me. I'm green. Please. Please. But I saw my mother's face, the smile the boy with the broken mouth had given me, like he had recognized something of himself in me. I knew what I was. Green. I looked up at the sound of the voice that floated down to me. I stared, and he stared right back, his eyes unfocused. He was mumbling something now, his mouth full of mush like he was chewing on the words. "I'm green," he said, shaking his head. His voice sounded stronger. I was still on the floor when he went to shut down the machine, and so shocked when he sat back down at the desk that I actually forgot to cry. But it wasn't until he picked up the green spray paint and drew that enormous X over the back of the uniform shirt and handed it to me that I remembered to start breathing. "It'll be okay," I told myself as I walked back down the cold hallway, down the steps, to the girls and men in uniforms waiting for me below. It wasn't until that night, as I lay awake in my bunk, that I realized I would only ever have one chance to run, and I hadn't taken it. 3. Samantha, Sam, and I were both assigned to Cabin 27, along with the rest of the girls from our bus that were classified as green. 14 in all, though by the next day there were 20 more. They capped the number at 30 a week later and moved on to filling the next wooden structure along the camp's perpetually soggy and trampled main trail. Bunks were assigned based on alphabetical order, which put Sam directly above me. A small mercy, seeing as the rest of the girls were nothing like her. They spent the first night either stunned into silence or sobbing. I didn't have time for tears anymore. I had questions. "What are they going to do with us?" I whispered up to her. We were at the far left end of the cabin, our bunk wedged in the corner. The walls of the structure had been thrown together so quickly that they weren't completely sealed. Every now and then a freezing draft and sometimes a snowflake whistled in from the silent outdoors. "I don't know," she said quietly. A few beds over, one of the girls had finally dropped off into the oblivion of sleep, and her snores were helping to cover our conversation. When a PSF had escorted us to our new residence, it had been with several warnings. No talking after lights out, no leaving, no use of freak abilities, intentional or accidental. It was the first time I had ever heard anyone refer to what we could do as freak abilities, instead of the polite alternative, symptoms.
"I guess keep us here until they figure out a cure," Sam continued. "That's what my dad said, at least, when the soldiers came to get me. What did your parents say?"
My hands hadn't stopped shaking from earlier, and every time I tried shutting my eyes, all I could see were the white coats, blank ones, staring right back into mine. The mention of my parents only made the pounding in my head that much worse. I don't know why I lied. It was easier, I guess, than the truth. Or maybe because some small part of it felt like it was the actual truth. "My parents are dead." She sucked in a sharp breath between her teeth.
"I wish mine were, too."
"You don't mean that."
"They're the ones that sent me here, aren't they?"
It was dangerous how fast her voice was rising.
"Obviously, they wanted to get rid of me."
I don't think... I began, only to stop myself. Hadn't my parents wanted to get rid of me, too?
"Whatever. It's fine," she said, though it clearly wasn't, and it wasn't ever going to be. "We'll stay here and stick together, and when we get out, we can go wherever we want, and no one will stop us."
My mom used to say that sometimes just saying something aloud was enough to make it true. I wasn't so sure about that, but the way Sam said it, the low burn beneath her words, made me reconsider. It suddenly seemed possible that it could work out that way, that if I couldn't go home, I would still be all right in the end if I could just stick with her. It was like wherever Sam went, a path opened up behind her. All I had to do was stay in her shadow, out of the PSF's line of sight, and avoid doing anything that would call attention to me. It worked that way for 5 years. 5 years feels like a lifetime when one day bleeds into the next, and your world doesn't stretch any farther than the gray electric fence surrounding 2 miles of shoddy buildings and mud. I was never happy at Thurmond, but it was bearable because Sam was there to make it that way. She was there with the eye roll when Vanessa, one of our cabin mates, tried to cut her own hair with garden shears to look more stylish. "For who?" Sam had muttered,
her reflection in the washroom mirror. The silly cross-eyed face behind the back of the PSF lecturing her for speaking out of turn yet again. And the firm, but gentle, reality check when the girl's imaginations started running too wild, or rumors sprung up about the PSFs letting us go. Sam and I, we were realists. We knew we weren't getting out. Dreaming led to disappointment, and disappointment to a kind of depressed funk that wasn't easy to shake. Better to stay in the gray than get eaten by the dark. 2 years into life at Thurmond, the camp controllers started work on the factory. They had failed at rehabilitating the dangerous ones and hauled them off in the night, but the so-called improvements didn't stop there. It dawned on them that the camp needed to be entirely self-sufficient. From that point on, we'd be growing and cooking our own food to eat, mucking out the washrooms, making our uniforms, and even making theirs. The brick structure was all the way at the far west side of the camp, cupped in one end of Thurmond's long rectangle. They had us dig out the foundation for the factory, but the camp controllers didn't trust us with the actual building of it. We watched it go up, floor by floor, wondering what it was for, and what they would do to us there. That was back when all sorts of rumors were floating around like dandelion fluff in the wind. Some thought the scientists were coming back for more experiments. Some thought the new building was where they were going to move the reds, oranges, and yellows, if and when they returned. And some thought it was where they were going to get rid of us, once and for all. "We'll be fine," Sam had told me one night, just before they turned the lights out. "No matter what. You hear me?" But it wasn't fine. It wasn't fine then, and it wasn't fine now. There was no talking in the factory, but there were ways around it. Actually, the only time we were allowed to speak to one another was in our cabin before lights out. Everywhere else, it was all work, obedience, silence. But you can't go on for years together without developing a different kind of language, one that was all sly grins and quick glances. Today, they had us polishing and relacing the PSF's boots and tightening their uniform buttons, but a single wiggle of a loose black shoelace and a look toward the girl standing across from you, the same one who had called you an awful word the night before, spoke volumes. The factory wasn't much of a factory. A better name probably would have been the warehouse, only because the building consisted of just one huge room with a pathway suspended over the work floor. The builders had enough thought to install four large windows on the west and east walls, but because there was no heat in the winter or AC in the summer, they tended to let more bad weather in than sunlight. The camp controllers tried to keep things as simple as possible. They set up rows and rows of tables lengthwise across the dusty concrete floor. There were hundreds of us working in the factory that morning, all in green uniforms. 10 PSFs patrolled the walkways above us, each with his or her own black rifle. Another 10 were on the ground with us. It was no more unnerving than usual to feel the press of their eyes coming from every direction. But I hadn't slept well the night before, even after a full day of work in the garden. I had gone to bed with a headache and woken up with a glossy fever fog over my brain and a sore throat to match. Even my hands seemed lethargic, my fingers stiff as pencils. I knew I wasn't keeping up, but it was like drowning in a way. The harder I tried to work to keep my head above water, the more tired I felt and the slower I became. After a while, even standing upright was taking too much effort, and I had to brace myself against the table to keep from swan diving straight into it. On most days, I could get away with a snail's pace. It wasn't like they had us doing important work or that we had deadlines to meet. Every task we were assigned was just glorified busy work to keep our hands moving, our bodies occupied, and our minds dead with boredom. Sam called it forced recess. They let us out of our cabins, and the work wasn't difficult or tiring like it was in the garden, but no one wanted to be there, especially when bullies came to the playground. I knew he was standing behind me long before I heard him start counting the finished, shiny shoes in front of me. He smelled like spiced meat and car oil, which already was an unsettling combination before a whiff of cigarette smoke was added to the mix. I tried to straighten my back under the weight of his gaze, but it felt like he had taken two fists and dug the knuckles deep between my shoulder blades. 15, 16, 17. How was it that they could make mere numbers sound sharp? At Thurmond, we weren't allowed to touch one another, and we were beyond forbidden to touch one of the PSFs, but it didn't mean that they couldn't touch us. The man took two steps forward. His boots, exactly like the ones on the table, nudged the back of my standard white slip-ons. When I didn't respond, he snuck an arm past my shoulder on the pretense of sorting through my work and pressed me into his chest. Shrink, I told myself, curling my spine down, bending my face to the task in front of me. Shrink and disappear. Worthless, I heard the PSF grunt behind me. His body was letting off enough heat to warm the entire building. You're doing this all wrong. Look. Watch, girl. I got my first real glance at him out of the corner of my eye as he ripped the polish-stained cloth out of my hand and moved to my side. He was short, only an inch or two taller than me, with a stubby nose and cheeks that seemed to flap every time he took a breath. Like this, he was saying, swiping at the boot he had taken. Look at me. A trick. We weren't supposed to look them directly in the eyes, either. I heard a few chuckles around me, not from the girls, but from more PSFs gathered at his back. It felt like I was boiling from the inside out. It was December, and the factory couldn't have been warmer than 40 degrees, but lines of sweat were racing down the curves of my cheeks, and I felt a hard, stiff cough welling up in my throat. There was a light touch at my side. Sam couldn't look up from her own work, but I saw her eyes slide over to me, trying to assess the situation. A wave of furious red was making its way up from her throat to her face, and I could only imagine the kinds of words she was holding back. Her bony elbow brushed against mine again, as if to remind me that she was still there. Then, with agonizing slowness, I felt the same PSF move behind me again, brushing my shoulder and arm with his own as he gently deposited the boot back on the table in front of me. "These boots," he said in a low, purring voice as he tapped the plastic bin containing all of my finished work. "Did you lace them?" If I hadn't known what kind of punishment I'd get for it, I would have burst out into tears. I felt more stupid and ashamed the longer I stood there, but I couldn't say anything. I couldn't move. My tongue had swelled up to twice its usual size behind my clenched teeth. The thoughts buzzing around my head were light and edged with a strange, milky quality. My eyes could barely focus now. More snickers from behind us. The laces are all wrong. His other arm wrapped around my left side until there wasn't an inch of his body that wasn't pressed up against mine. Something new rose in my throat, and it tasted strongly of acid. The tables around us had gone completely quiet and still. My silence only egged him on. With no warning, he picked up the bin of boots and flipped it over, so dozens of boots scattered across the length of the table with a terrible amount of noise. Now everyone in the factory was looking. Everyone saw me, thrust out into the light. Wrong, 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 he sang out, knocking the boots around. But they weren't. They were perfect. They were just boots. But I knew whose feet would slide into them. I knew better than to screw it up. Are you as deaf as you are dumb, Green? And then, clear as day, low as thunder, I heard Sam say, That was my bin. And all I could think of was, no, oh no. I felt the PSF shift behind me, pull back in surprise. They always acted this way, surprised that we remembered how to use words and use them against them. What did you say? He barked. I could see the insult rising to her lips. She was rolling it around on her tongue like a piece of hard lemon candy. You heard me. Or did inhaling that polish kill whatever helpless brain cells you had left? I knew what she wanted when she looked over at me. I knew what she was waiting for. It was exactly what she had just given me. Backup. I hung back a step, crossing my arms over my stomach. Don't do it, I told myself. Don't. She can handle it. Sam had nothing to hide, and she was brave, but every time she did this, every time she stood up for me and I shrunk back in fear, I felt like I was betraying her. Once again, my voice was locked away behind layers of caution and fear. If they were to look into my file, if they were to see the blanks there and start looking into filling them, no punishment they'd give Sam would ever compare to the one they'd give me. That was what I told myself, at least. The right side of the guy's lips inched up, turning a grim line into a mocking smirk. We've got a live one. Come on. Come on, Ruby. It was all in the tilt of her head and the tightness of her shoulders. She didn't understand what would happen to me. I wasn't brave like she was. But I wanted to be. I so wanted to be. I can't. I didn't have to say the words aloud. She read it easily enough on my face. I saw the realization come together behind her eyes even before the PSF stepped forward and took her arm, yanking her away from the table and from me. Turn around, I begged. Her blonde ponytail was swinging with each step, rising above the shoulders of the PSFs escorting her out. Turn around. I needed her to see how sorry I was, to understand the clenching in my chest and the nausea in my stomach had nothing to do with the fever. Every single desperate thought that ran through my head made me feel sick with disgust. The eyes that had been on me lifted two by two, and the soldier never came back to finish his personal brand of torment. There was no one left to see me cry. I had learned to do it silently, without any fuss, years ago. They had no reason to so much as look my way again. I was back in the long shadow Sam had left behind. The punishment for speaking out of turn was a day's worth of isolation, handcuffed to one of the gateposts in the garden, regardless of the temperature or the weather. I'd seen kids sitting in a mound of snow, blue in the face, and without a single blanket to cover them. Even more sunburned, covered in mud, or trying to scratch patches of bug bites with her free hands. Unsurprisingly, the punishment for talking back to a PSF or camp controller was the same, only you also weren't given food and sometimes not even water. The punishment for a repeat offense was something so terrible Sam wouldn't or couldn't talk about it when she finally returned to our cabin 2 days later. She came in, wet and shaking from the winter rain, looking like she had slept no more than I had. I slid off my bunk and was on my feet, rushing to her side before she had even made it halfway across the cabin. My hand slipped around her arm, but she pulled away, her jaw clenched in a way that made her look almost ferocious. Her cheeks and nose had been wind-whipped to a bright red, but she didn't have any bruises or cuts. Her eyes weren't even swollen from crying like mine were. There was a subtle limp to her walk, maybe, but if I hadn't known what had happened, I would have just assumed she was coming in from a long afternoon of working in the garden. Sam? I said, hating the way my voice shook. She didn't stop or deign to look at me until we were by our bunks, and she had one fist curled in her bedsheets, ready to pull herself up to the top bed. Say something. Please? I begged. You stood there. Sam's voice was low and rough, like she hadn't used it for days. You shouldn't have... Her chin came down to rest against her chest. Long, tangled masses of hair fell over her shoulders and cheeks, hiding her expression. I felt it then, the way that the hold I had on her had suddenly sprung free. I had the strangest sensation of floating, of drifting farther and farther away with nothing and no one to cling to. I was standing right beside her, but the distance between us had split into the kind of canyon I couldn't jump across. You're right, Sam said finally. I shouldn't have. She drew in a shuddering breath. But then, what would have happened to you? You would have just stood there and let him do that, and you wouldn't have defended yourself at all. And then she was looking at me, and all I wanted was for her to turn away again. Her eyes